This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last week, we spent an hour discussing fracking in North Carolina. State officials are in the process of hearing public comment on rules and regulations they put forward to govern the practice. On the program, we had a geologist not associated with the state nor with industry efforts to start fracking here, a professional engineer whose company is cited as among the world's most ethical and environmentally responsible, and although that engineer and his company have been involved in drilling and fracking elsewhere, they are not involved in any efforts to push the process in this state. And we had a representative of Piedmont Natural Gas, a company not involved in fracking, but by its own admission, one that would benefit from greater access to new sources of natural gas at lower prices. We felt it was a balanced panel, but we heard from many of you complaining that it was not. To quote one response, Charlotte Talks today on the pros and cons of fracking was all industry spin to dispel the authentic concerns some informed people have about this proposed industrial-strength mining operation in our front yards. We disagree with that statement, but admit, given the complexity of the issue and some of the concerns that even our guests last week expressed, fracking certainly deserves a further probe, as does the way the state has gone about formulating the rules that might potentially govern the practice. Even experts say that although the proposed regulations are very thorough on the technical aspects, in fact, some of the most stringent in the nation, they are not as clear on enforcement and penalties. With that in mind, we take another look in an effort to specifically address some of the questions and concerns expressed by those who emailed us and posted on Facebook last week about the laws in place and the rules being formulated. Joining us now is James Womack, chairman of the Mining and Energy Commission. That is the body formulating those rules and regulations. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. Let me correct one thing, though. I'm the ex-chairman. I gave up that role to Dr. Rao on the 1st of August.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the correction. Cassie Gavin is Director of Governmental Affairs for the North Carolina Sierra Club. That's an environmental organization, and she joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Andy Bobiarczyk is back. He is an associate professor of earth sciences in the Department of Geography and Earth Sciences at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for coming back today. And I want to start with you.
Okay.
And some of your concerns and those of some of the other guests on the program last week actually came out after the show went off the air, which kind of surprised me and disappointed me a little bit. So let me ask you before we get into the nitty-gritty of all this, as a geologist, how comfortable are you with fracking, and how comfortable are you that the regulations stipulated in the laws passed by the legislature and the regulations being formulated right now by the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission are adequate to govern the practice, police the practice, and fine those who might violate whatever regulations are adopted?
Well, I can address the science first, and of course we wouldn't be here if there wasn't pretty good evidence that there are potential source beds for at least gas in North Carolina.
But are you comfortable with the practice of fracking as a geologist?
Yes, it's very widely used and used in oil and gas and can even be used in groundwater. And also it's a form of process used in geothermal energy.
Know all that, but as a geologist, are you comfortable with the fact that they do it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay. Now, what about the regulations and the laws that have been written and the regulations that have been formulated?
Well, the set of draft rules, as I understand it, Mr. Romack can update us on that.
Sure.
Are I think to be finalized and presented in October. I think there's one more open meeting coming up.
But what you know about them?
Yeah.
Are they sufficient? Are they protective enough? Do you have concerns about them?
I think there are gaps in there that still need to be addressed. In particular, just to cite one example, I think there's still discussion needed on how to dispose of and handle drilling fluids. Right now, I believe the rules allow open pit storage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people across the board are uncomfortable with that form of processing.
Mr. Womack, North Carolina Senate Bill 820, the Clean Energy and Economic Security Act, created the Mining and Energy Commission and required it to, quote, develop a modern regulatory program for the management of oil and gas exploration and development activities in the state, including the use of horizontal drilling, which we talked about a lot last week, and hydraulic fracturing for that purpose. Now, you spent the better part of, I think, 2 years coming up with that regulatory program, and you're now in the public comment phase. How would you describe what the commission has come up with?
Well, we've spent the best part of 2 years reviewing what the other states have done, looking at best practices across the country. And I think we put together a very comprehensive set of rules. I might take a little bit of disagreement with Dr. Bobiarchik that I don't think we have any substantial gaps. I think we've done the best we can to try to coalesce a set of rules that address what we think are the necessary framework for safe and responsible drilling in the state. Others might disagree, and we respect those disagreements. We would expect them to address those in writing or orally during the public comment period. I would say that in the areas of open pit storage of wastewater, that's an area of contention at this point. We respect that. And we're looking forward to reviewing all the comments that come in. Those kinds of contentions certainly deserve to be reviewed. And if there are some suggestions about how we can improve on that process, particularly where other states may have had or other practices may be improved, we would consider those comments and potentially make changes to the rules that we've drafted.
Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Cassie Gavin, but I'm sure that the Sierra Club is not terribly pleased with the open pit provisions. Is that the case, and are there other things that concern you?
That's correct. Actually, the wastewater disposal issue is one of our biggest concerns about what's lacking in the proposed rules, and we basically don't think that permits to frack should be issued until that issue is taken care of. The MEC proposed rules don't yet get us there.
Okay,
let me offer one comment there. That's not about wastewater disposal, though. Open pit storage of wastewater is not disposal. That is a temporary holding impoundment, and wastewater disposal is not done through storage in open pits. Wastewater disposal in the state of North Carolina is not done through deep water or deep well injection, or like it's done in other states, it's done through recycling of that water. So, you know, there has been some confusion that people think we're just going to leave water stored like coal ash for long periods of time in pits, and that's not the case. This is just a temporary storage in pits until such time that it's recycled and properly disposed of through treatment.
The Mining and Energy Commission has formulated 120 or so rules to regulate the oil and gas industry as it develops shale resources here. Some experts say that the 19 things that the Senate bill required your commission to accomplish were a tall order, not easy to accomplish, but what you came up with are among the toughest regulations in the nation, particularly when it comes to the technical rules about how wells should be constructed. Would you agree with that? I'm sure you would.
I think we did. We absolutely stuck to what the American Petroleum Institute recommends as best practices and rigorous standards across the country. I think our rules stack up very nicely against the API standards.
Well, let me ask for a clarification on that, because when you say we're going to follow the guidelines of the American Petroleum Institute, that sends up a billion red flags for a lot of people. Who are they to tell you how to regulate themselves?
Well, you understand that the American Petroleum Institute is also a system of a organization with very rigorous engineering standards that are observed across a broad spectrum of engineers and scientists, and they are well respected across the not only the industry but also the system of engineers that regulate and monitor the industry. So, you know, if you look at the API standards, they are well respected across even the environmental groups. Now, I'm not suggesting that they are the only set of standards that you look at, but API standards are very well respected across the country.
Cassie Gavin, how do you feel about the API?
Yeah, so when the legislature legalized fracking in 2012, they did promise that North Carolina would have the best and strongest rules in the country. A lot of the proposed rules do not live up to that promise. Specifically, I'm thinking of like setbacks to water resources and wells and some other areas, but especially in the water resources area.
Okay. And we're going to spend some time on water a little bit later on here. And as Cassie Gavin just said, Mr. Womack, some of the same experts who praise the strictness of the technical regulations bemoan the lack of clarity when it comes to enforcing those regulations and penalizing those who would break them. They point to the current bill that allows the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, DENR, to levy fines of $25,000 per day. But there's a question as to how they might do that, when those fines might be levied, and why they might do so. How do you feel about those criticisms?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the nature of the criticisms, frankly. The beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The criticisms about how DENR might establish those fines is questioning something that hasn't happened yet. And I can't pass a judgment on something that hasn't happened.
Well, some say that the result of this is it's like having a speed limit or a stop sign on a road, but no police to enforce either. And that they also cite what they describe as woefully low taxes and fees. Right now, evidently, a permit to drill costs about $5,000 per well, plus a dollar per linear foot drilled, or about $7,000 in total permit fees per well. But because we can now drill horizontally, companies will have considerably fewer wells and considerably fewer fees. That means fewer fees, less taxes, less revenue coming into the state.
But I don't know what you're what measure you're comparing that against. I don't understand what the criticism is.
There's not enough money. There's not enough money to enforce some of the provisions because we're not going to take in enough money because of the nature of how fracking is conducted.
But see, what are you measuring that against? I don't understand.
Regular oil wells.
But a regular oil well. I mean, how much taxing is enough? I guess that's the question I would ask you.
Well, I guess the criticism is coming from people who have done this in the industry and who say that. There needs to be enough money to build roads, for instance, to take the heavy trucks in and out of the oil areas, the fracking areas. There needs to be enough money to be able to police what's going on, and they feel that there may not be enough money coming in from tax dollars and fees to do that.
Well, and so what my recommendation would be, if there are issues or people that have criticism that think that we're not taxing the industry enough or we're not exacting enough fines or fees or taxes from the industry, what they should do is they should put that in writing and send that to the North Carolina General Assembly, because that's not the purview of the Mining and Energy Commission. That's the purview of the North Carolina General Assembly.
Okay.
They reserve the authority and the right to do that. That's not something the Mining and Energy Commission would do.
If I could jump in, one thing I would say is that the whole consideration of the economic balance of if fracking were to occur, how we would pay for it and support it, hasn't really been addressed. It's not essentially one of the objectives of the set of rules. And if you read through all the comments people make from all different directions, that's one of the things that's being asked for is let's do a study and figure out exactly what those bottom line numbers are.
Have similar studies been done in other states?
I don't know.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with James Womack, a former chair of the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission, formulating the rules that are going to govern fracking in North Carolina, Cassie Gavin, director of governmental affairs with the North Carolina Sierra Club, and Dr. Andy Babiarchik with UNC Charlotte. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green leads the orchestra in Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica, plus Dvorak's Cello Concerto, September 19th and 20th in the Belk Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Signature Healthcare, celebrating 10 years of offering concierge medical care, providing patients with 24/7 patient access, personalized executive health care, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. Well, there's wine, and then there's fine wine. Do you think you can tell the difference? If you can, you might be interested to know that this state is the home of the largest fine wine auction in the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic region. And if you cannot tell the difference but would like to learn, we're going to gather three fine wine experts to join us tomorrow to talk about how to experience fine wines, whether price and quality actually go together, and about the rise in counterfeit fine wines. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the WHO predicts there'll be 20,000 Ebola infections by year's end. Other estimates are far higher. Understanding the potential scale of the expanding crisis and the international response.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're revisiting our fracking discussion of last week because we got such a great deal of response from listeners, much of it critical, about the program that we conducted last week on this topic. And so we're doing it again with different sets of guests, although Dr. Andy Bobiarchek is with us, a geologist from UNC Charlotte. He was with us last week as well. Cassie Gavin is Director of Governmental Affairs for the Sierra Club here in the state. And James Womack is the former chair of the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission. The other item that stands out, Mr. Womack, with some of the people we've talked to who are experts in this field, say is the lack of clarity on the benefit and compensation that the state and landowners would see in the form of taxes on the gas extracted and royalties to landowners. This is set up as something that evidently would be negotiated in the future. Is that the way you see it? Is that true?
Well, the commission itself has not seen fit to develop rules around that. It wasn't one of the directives we received from the General Assembly, and it's certainly not one of the things that is commonly done state to state. We haven't chosen the right rules to direct what would be in the form or the substance of contracts that would be written between landowners and the oil and gas companies, and we have resisted the temptation to do that. We believe that that is a matter of contract law and that should be negotiated between landowners and those companies. Let me just also add one thing. Just before break, there was some discussion about the studies related to finance and shale energy. I would point out that Duke University has performed recently a very comprehensive study about taxing and the revenue flows that go with the industry, and they did this comprehensively across the country. I think it's one of the landmark studies in the country, and I would point you back to Duke's recent study that was released in a paper. It had, I know, at least a dozen different states participated in that study, as well as North Carolina, and there is a very informed study related to shale energy finance and the taxation that goes with that. And I think that's a pretty authoritative study about taxation and how much is enough.
Much of the concern expressed by listeners after the last program was surrounding the potential environmental damage that could be done through the practice of fracking and the responsibility of the people doing it and whether they will live up to their responsibilities. In fact, Richard in Charlotte has just sent us an email saying just because fracking can be done safely doesn't mean that it will be done safely. Are we going to have a regimen, the resources and the willpower to provide real confidence that the operators will drill safely? We need to prevent accidents, not worry about chasing phantom equity for damage claims after the fact. But that's one of the other concerns, damage claims after the fact. Some say that the bonds that drilling companies must put up prior to operation for damage or repairs will protect the state, but how landowners who are damaged might benefit is not clear. Is that how you see it, Mr. Womack?
Well, I think that's always a case for any industry. You certainly want to make sure that they're performing in a responsible and safe manner. And I think that having $1 million bond posted for a well is certainly an adequate. That's way above and beyond what most industries are required to perform. In fact, I think it's unprecedented among industries in the state. We have a very rigorous set of rules that require very stringent standards of these companies. The well construction standards and the standards for water withdrawal, monitoring and testing for releases into the environment. These are very rigorous standards that these companies have to follow. It imposes It imposes some very rigorous monitoring standards on the company, and it requires a very rigorous set of inspections on the company. So I believe, now I'm not going to defend that the rules are the best that we can make them. I believe that we've done a very good job of developing the rules, but I do believe that they can be improved upon. And I do believe that with proper consideration of the public inputs that we will do that. So that's, you know, I would just leave it at that if we receive public comments and we consider those public comments, that we'll have the very best set of rules that we can produce for the state.
Cassie-Gavin, $1 million bond is a lot of money, it seems to me, but it's also a pittance, it also seems to me, for oil and gas companies. And can you put a price on what you're mostly concerned about, and that is damage to the aquifer?
So what we're talking about here is the environmental damage bonding section of the proposed rules. And indeed, North Carolina's proposed rules have $1 million bond. But as we know, environmental cleanup can be very expensive. And I've actually seen some higher bonding requirements in places like Fort Worth, Texas, and Arlington, Texas. They require operators to have a $5 million per loss environmental liability insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So there are places that have higher bonding requirements, and North Carolina might, you know, want to increase our environmental damage bond.
Let's go back to something that you talked about earlier, and that was your concern over the wastewater rules proposed by the Mining and Energy Commission. You say they're insufficient. In what way are they insufficient?
So this is really the biggest area of concern for Sierra Club, is that wastewater disposal and, you know, just what happens overall with where does the wastewater go, how does it get treated, where does it eventually end up? That there really isn't a viable solution proposed for that in our rules. And until we have that, we shouldn't be issuing fracking permits.
Dr. Bobiarchek, is there a way to handle wastewater safely?
There is, but it's also a matter of the size of the infrastructure. And I think what Cassie is getting at, as well as I would say, is that we don't have the capacity to handle the drilling fluids that we generated. As Mr. Womack said, we're not going to allow reinjection of fluids into the subsurface. And so that means they have to go somewhere. Do they go to wastewater treatment plants? Does some entrepreneur set up a series of processing plants for recycling? It's sort of a big question mark right now.
I'm sure you've heard this criticism before, Mr. Womack. Do you have ideas about where this water might go or how it might be treated ultimately?
Yes, we made a conscientious effort to evaluate what other states have done and what's most practical for this state. We just don't have the geology and the hydrogeology in North Carolina to support Class II injection wells, which is what a lot of other states have done. We also are sensitive to the seismic activity that can be triggered through that deep well injection of wastewater. So we've chosen to outlaw that in the state. So what we're left with are the treatment and reuse of wastewater until such time that there's no longer any use of that of the old slick water, and at such time that we would have to then re-release that into the environment. And so the only two options you really have are the treatment and reuse, or treatment and pre-treatment, and then sending it to a wastewater treatment facility, or the MPDES. Re-release into the environment.
Well,
so those are your really only two options that you have.
Is it a good idea to issue permits then before we know how we're going to ultimately deal with all this wastewater?
Well, yes. I mean, it is a good practice to know how you're going to deal with the release of that wastewater and the two options that you have. Well, actually, three options. There's the treatment and re-release into the environment, a treatment or pre-treatment and sending it to a wastewater treatment facility, or the trucking of it out of state into another state where it can be released into a Class II injection well. Those are your three options.
And what are we going to do?
Well, it's the option of the industry. It's their wastewater. Once they've had a permit to withdraw it, they have any of those three options or all of those three options. And they have the ability to do any or all of those three. Southwestern Energy, for example, has demonstrated to us in the state of Arkansas the use of all three of those options, and they are doing it very effectively in the state of Arkansas, which has a shale deposit, which is very similar to what we have in the state of North Carolina.
Doctor?
Well, but and he's right. All of those methods are used. I think Pennsylvania ships its wastewater to Ohio or something like that. But I think the central question is, were we to begin issuing permits to start in 2015 or 2016, is there sufficient capability to handle those fluids? And from my perspective, they don't seem to be there.
Anywhere in the country or in North Carolina?
In North Carolina.
But if they ship it out to Ohio, does it matter?
Well, we'd have to ask Ohio if they have the capacity to handle all the Marcellus fluids coming down from Pennsylvania and New York, as well as North Carolina.
You mentioned Pennsylvania, so let's go there for a second. Fracking not only impacts our nation's energy position, it potentially enriches the coffers of private energy and drilling companies and the coffers of the state. It has an impact, and a profound one, on citizens, as we learned after last week's show. We sent Charlotte Talks producer Alexia Girodi out to speak to someone whose family is quite familiar with the uncertainties and difficulties that can come with fracking. She spoke with Daniel Wilson Brown. He's a geologist and a professional engineer, but his family owns land in northwest of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, in the Marcellus Shale area. And he spoke to us from his personal, not his professional, point of view.
My grandparents signed a gas lease back in the mid-90s, and after they passed away, my parents and my aunts inherited the land and that lease. And they went to a lawyer in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and actually tried to see if there was a way to get out of the lease, but they couldn't, because the way that lease was set up is it could go on forever or in perpetuity as long as the gas companies do any kind of work on the property itself, whether it's just building a maintenance road or laying some pipe down. So my family had to live with it. They were basically stuck with the lease, and there was no way to get out of it. And that caused some tensions in the family and some issues. We have cousins who also have property nearby who were not interested in having fracking wells anywhere near their property and didn't want gas line pipes running through there. And even amongst the family, between myself, my parents, my aunts, we don't all have the same opinion about whether we really want a fracking well on the property.
So that's in Pennsylvania. So Mr. Womack, what kind of regulations are being suggested about how these contracts with landowners in North Carolina might be worded?
Well, again, it's not the purview of the Mining and Energy Commission to get into contract law. That is it's a legal matter. There are other statutes that govern what goes on with contract law in the state, and that's really more for the Attorney General's office.
The Sierra Club, Cassie, says that neither the Mining and Energy Commission nor the legislature has yet addressed the question of forced pooling, which means that existing law would remain in place. Talk about forced pooling first and how that would impact landowners.
Sure. Yeah, forced pooling is a very big question having to do with fracking that is yet still unanswered and really deserves an answer before the state starts issuing fracking permits. Forced pooling would basically allow landowners who haven't signed a lease to be required to enter into a lease if the neighbors around them desire to do so. And there's different requirements that can go along with that as far as how many landowners would be required to say yes before someone would be required to do so. But none of that has been set up by the legislature yet, so we just don't know.
So as it stands now, if one landowner says yes to fracking, but their neighbor is opposed, we don't know who wins that argument?
So right now, existing law is that North Carolina does allow forced pooling, but the law dates back to 1945.
Okay.
So it really wasn't designed with fracking in mind.
But fracking could impact the aquifer that people share. And if one person says yes, or five people say yes, and three people say no, and the pooling laws allow the fracking to proceed, do you have no say-so over your own water rights, Mr. Womack? And I know that you're going to tell me that this is something that the legislature should decide. That said, what's the rush? Why not get these ducks in a row before we say yes to this?
Well, water rights are water rights. And if it's determined that you have your water rights, then the shale energy development does not impugn your water rights. That's, again, a legal matter. So let's not mix the metaphors here. If you have water rights, you're not going to lose your water rights as a result of
no,
the
but
shale
if your industry. But if your water is damaged by the fracking operation, which you don't want in your backyard, then you really don't have any water rights.
Well, you're again mixing your legal terms. Water rights are water rights, and your shale energy rights or your mineral rights are separate from your water rights. Okay, if you are compelled into a pool under the compulsory pooling laws of the state, those are separate and distinct from your water rights. Okay, the compulsory pooling laws of the state are there to protect landowner rights as well as they are to compel pooling into a drilling unit. And I would like to hasten to add that we have expressed the desires of the Mining and Energy Commission through a study group report, which is there for everyone to read. We have expressed what we would like to see from the Mining and Energy Commission standpoint. We've put that back before the General Assembly. Now, we have not chosen to write any rules on compulsory pooling. At this point, we've left that in the hands of the General Assembly. The Department of Environment and Natural Resources has now been tasked to go back and prepare its views on that same subject and to render an opinion to the General Assembly before the General Assembly pronounces what its final opinion is on compulsory pooling. So the final verdict is still out. But at this juncture, as we enter into the possible phase of issuing permits, the Mining and Energy Commission has the final say, and at this point we will issue drilling units. And we do have the authority to issue a compulsory pooling order if necessary. At this point, we are going to be very reserved, I do believe, in whether or not we would issue a compulsory pooling order. And I do believe we'd follow the desires that we expressed in the initial study group report, that we would be very reserved on issuing a compulsory pooling order unless we had a voluntary service unit agreement, unless, you know, 90% or more of the landowners in the unit were voluntary leaseholders.
Let me go back to Daniel Brown, who went to went on to talk about some other concerns he and his extended family have about fracking, the fracking lease that they cannot get out of, and what it might mean once fracking begins on their property in Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
The well was drilled and installed in 2005. They haven't fracked it yet, but eventually we expect them to frack the well. And our main concerns are just the groundwater protection on the farm, because everyone uses well water there, and it's so far away from any municipality, you really won't be able to bring in city water. So there's always the question is the actual fracking of the well, and as they extract the gas out of the well, is it going to be done professionally and safely with good oversight and good quality control to protect the aquifer of the area? And the other question is it really worth the money when you think about all the hassle of, you know, having all the drill rigs and all the fracking going on there at the family farm, and then the tension just between the family members of, like, is it worth the money? Is it worth the risk to you as a homeowner or a landowner? Like, is your groundwater safe? And, you know, you don't really know, and it's hard to say what's going to happen in the future. It's not always easy to test the water, and how often would they test the water, and do they test for the right things? And the ownership of the actual well changes often, and you don't know when the next company who buys the well, are they going to be as open about, you know, the fracking fluids and what material they're putting down the well and what type of quality control they might have.
Which raises a couple of questions about how we're handling that in North Carolina, which we'll get to after we come back from the break. And we'll also come back and talk a lot about your concerns from the last show and share those with our guest. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, presenting the Big Sweep annual cleanup of creeks and lakes Saturday, September 27th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Volunteer opportunities and information at stormwater.charmec.org. And the Culture and Heritage Museums, presenting By the Sweat of Our Brows. Historic interpreters recreate the lives of 1800s African Americans with songs, stories, and more. Historic Brattonsville, September 13th. chmuseums.org. The World Health Organization predicts that there will be 20,000 Ebola infections by year's end. Other estimates are far higher. So you can join Diane Rehm in about 20 minutes to discuss the potential scale of the expanding crisis and the international response. That's the Diane Rehm Show at 10 this morning. When we come back, more about possible fracking in North Carolina and lots of your comments and questions. Stay with us.
You got your money in politics. We all know about that, right? Then you got your reality.
We are legitimately in a position where 200 people can essentially decide who is going to be the next president.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's almost like saying big money just doesn't do it justice, isn't it? We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fracking with James Womack, the former chair of the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission, formulating the regulations that will govern fracking in this state. Cassie Gavin is director of governmental affairs for the Sierra Club here in North Carolina. And Dr. Andy Babiarchik is associate professor of earth sciences in the Department of Geography at UNC Charlotte. Getting back to what Daniel Brown said just prior to the break, he's a geologist and he has a family farm in Pennsylvania, and he was speaking as a non-professional in that situation, although he is a professional, about the concerns he and his family have up in Pennsylvania. Are the rules as they're being written in North Carolina, what kind of protection will people have if these wells change hands, as Daniel Brown indicated that his has, and if one company's practices are less stringent and careful than another's? Mr. Womack.
Well, you know, he raises some interesting questions, and I think it's, you know, the same thing that you would have when you signed a contract with a company to perform any operation. You have buyer beware. If you're gonna sign a contract, you have an option to put a clause in your contract that just like any other contract. If you want a singular contract where there's no change of hands of that contract, it needs to be built into that contract on that lease that says that this is a contract with this one company. If you refuse to enter into that contract, then that needs to be built into the contract.
But if one company is not as careful and not as pristine about how they approach this than another, why would that be allowed? Why aren't they all following everything to the letter of the law?
Well, you know, there are bad actor clauses in the state of North Carolina. The General Assembly built that into the last Senate Bill 786 this year. And the state does have the authority to prevent certain companies from that have had a reputation of poor performance in other states. There are some companies that have done that. That have got a reputation that it's bad in other states.
Well, that's one of the concerns that some experts have brought up, that because this is this will be a fledgling industry in North Carolina, we're not going to get the first-tier companies in here. We're going to get the second- and third-tier companies in here to test the water, so to speak, to see if this is really going to work, and they may not be as responsible as the top-tier companies would be.
Well, there'll be lots of criticisms. There are lots of reasons to say no. But I don't know that's a valid criticism. I mean, you can make that criticism. You can make any criticism. But okay. But the truth is that we have the ability to say no to drilling permits to any company.
In his last comment, Daniel Brown said that it's not always easy to test the water, and he wondered if these companies would test for the right things. Why wouldn't it be easy?
Well, first off, that's not an option of the company. Okay, mm-hmm. If you read the rules, we have mandated what's to be tested for in the water. And we have the most rigorous analytes to be tested for in the country. We test more often than any other state in the country. We test for more analytes than any other state in the country. And we test to a broader distance than any other state in the country. So that's not even an option.
But elaborate on that, because I'm not quite sure what the present rules say. Isn't a lot of that testing incumbent on the producer?
No, it has nothing to do. It's independent of the producer. We do a battery of tests. We test every well within a half mile of every gas well. We test for a broader set of analytes than any other company does, and we test over the life cycle of that well, of that gas well.
I want to spend the rest of the time we have left to us to getting answers to the questions that came in during our last program and reaction to some of the criticism levied as a result of that program. There was some question as to what is contained in fracking fluids. It's over 99%, I think it's 99.5% water and sand, but there are chemicals in it, some of which could be classified as trade secrets. And one emailer wrote, there is an FDA-approved alternative for each of the additives in fracking fluids, but it does not always apply in all cases. But North Carolina does not require that the clean fluids be evaluated first, and the regulations should do that.
That's not a correct statement.
That's not correct. What is correct?
That's not correct.
What is correct?
What is correct is that there are varying types and compositions of well stimulation fluids used around the country, and each of the companies, Baker Hughes, Chesapeake, Halliburton, Schlumberger, are the principal four, and there are some other types, other companies that use them. Each have their own secret sauce that they use for surfactants, biocides, et cetera, in those fluids. It's a small percentage by weight and by volume that go into the well stimulation mix. And each of those companies has their special fluids that they use that they've invested millions and millions of dollars into. Some companies have various mixtures that they use, and they tune those mixtures based on the composition of the shale that they're fracturing, and it varies from shale play to shale play. So they it's just like any other industrial process. They have to adjust the composition of the mixture
But if there is an accident that occurs that emergency responders have to respond to, or that environmentalists have to clean up after the fact, how can they clean up things they don't?
They will have access to that almost instantaneously. They'll have access to everything they need to know in the state of North Carolina.
Even the secret sauce that you talk about.
Yes, sir. They have access to that. We have provisions in our rules that allow for the disclosure of that information to emergency workers and medical personnel.
Okay. Peggy wanted to know, why can't they use air pressure instead of water pressure to do the fracking? And I believe after the show, Dr. Bobby Yarchuk, last week, you said that there are new technologies being investigated that might potentially eventually eliminate water from the equation.
Well, it depends a lot on the rocks and the depth at which you're working. The fracking process itself is multi-staged. You initiate the fractures with explosive charges in some cases, but to use air pressure to just do the fracking is a possibility. But the drilling fluids, the fracking fluids, carry a lot of other responsibility from the fracking itself. They help to lubricate the well and bring solid particles up to the surface. So you still have to find a way to perform those other duties.
You can't vacuum it out once you put I'm serious. I mean, if you can pressurize the air enough to break rock, can you not have a reverse vacuum that sucks it out?
No, you'd have to have a pretty gigantic vacuum.
Still need a biocide. You'd still need surfactants to lubricate. You know, you still need some of these other things.
Right. Terica in Sanford says, I live and own land here in Sanford. I have been here nearly 40 years. I've spent 2.5 years studying daily, researching, and wanting more than anything to see how fracking could be safely done in North Carolina. After going to many MEC meetings, the Mining and Energy Commission meetings, and even more compulsory pooling meetings, I am convinced that the 126 rules that are being brought to us are not right for the landowners and other residents. Example, setback distances are only 200 feet from surface waters. After seeing what has happened around the country, I do not believe it can be done safely. In those 126 rules, the word landowner is mentioned two times. Two times, she says, exclamation point. The compulsory pooling law has been passed, even though landowners continued to go to the meetings and ask for it not to happen. But to make the gas companies more profit, compulsory pooling has been forced on the landowners. Who wants to comment on that?
Well, Miss Luxton, you know, I've listened to her, and she's made some good comments at the Mining and Energy Commission meetings. And her points are well taken, but those compulsory pooling laws were passed in the 1940s. They weren't passed recently. Those rules have been around for a while, and she needs to take those pleas to the North Carolina General Assembly. Those weren't Mining and Energy Commission laws.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in here if possible.
Sure,
in regards
ahead
to the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to note that the state rules are really our only protection for protecting our water quality in North Carolina. Fracking is unique, as is oil and gas operations in general, in that they're exempt from most federal laws that you would think would normally protect your water quality, like the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act and a variety of other federal laws. So we are really counting on the Mining and Energy Commission rules along with the state legislature to protect us.
Okay. Well, Deb asks, please ask your guest Jim Womack why he refuses to have a North Carolina Mining and Energy hearing either in Anson, Union, or Mecklenburg counties before the September 30th public comment deadline ends. We need to address why North Carolina legislators have overridden local governments like my Anson County Commissioner's 5-year moratorium on fracking and proposed to rush fracking permits by early 2015.
Well, Deb, I assure you that I have bent over backwards to do as many of these public hearings as I can. We were only required by law to have one. I insisted and pressured everyone that I knew to do four, and I even offered to do one at my own personal expense out in the western Carolina counties. And that's the extent of what we could afford to do. I have volunteered to do at my own expense several town hall meetings in addition to the public hearings. I just got through doing one all the way out on the Georgia line in western North Carolina. I will offer my services to do additional town hall meetings, to do public outreach and education wherever we can.
Okay. Turk writes about a concern shared by many of the emailers who wrote us after the last show, and that's the potential impact, again, on the drinking water. Remember the BP oil spill, he says, that could not be stopped. What good is it to support massive oil and gas companies who are essentially earning without paying taxes while we, the people, are left with crap to clean up? They get the profits, we get the shaft. Fracking may give money to some and cheap gas to others, then unexpected accidents happen and a million can't get drinking water. Who cares about jobs created if we ruin our drinking water in the process? I cannot tell you how many people echoed that phrase, ruining our drinking water in the process, that it's not worth the risk.
Well, I would say part of the issue is that we have no experience with fracking in North Carolina.
But they do elsewhere. And there have been stories that have run in the national media. Maybe these stories are not true. I don't know. Mm. But they indicate that there are severe problems with the drinking water in the aquifers. And people talk about not being able to drink their water, lighting their faucets on fire, et cetera. I mean, talk about that.
I don't doubt that those experiences. They're singular experiences. They're unpleasant experiences. But when someone starts to say ruining drinking water for millions of North Carolinians, then you have to go back and look at the science and say, well, how widespread are the aquifers? We know about groundwater in the Mesozoic basins where these wells might go in. We have very little up-to-date and extensive observations on how the groundwater system works in the first place. So if you have an accident on one well, how far is that accident going to extend in terms of
implications? So we don't know is what you're saying.
I would say we need a lot more information.
But if you're living out there in the rural areas where this fracking is most likely to occur and you're getting your water from the aquifer because you can't get city water and you're affected negatively by this, you are affected negatively by this, period. End of discussion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Somebody took me to task for asking the question last week, is it worth the risk involved? Mm-hmm. And I asked that question because it's asked by experts in every industry in the country. There is a risk assessment on everything that's mm-hmm. done. Would you say, Cassie, that that's an unfair question to ask, or is that a question that you're satisfied yet with the answer that you've received?
I think it's a great question to ask. And, you know, North Carolina is unique. Our shale gas deposits, I understand, are closer to the surface and water aquifers than other places where fracking has been done. So that means there's a bigger risk of drinking water contamination. And we need to think hard about whether we should be investing in this direction or, you know, jumping forward to renewable energy and efficiency instead.
Under the laws written by the legislature and the regulations that the Mining Commission has formulated, if a well is, in fact, ultimately contaminated, who is responsible for cleaning it up, Mr. Womack?
Well, the presumptive liability immediately falls to the oil and gas company, to not only to provide the clean water, all the abundant clean water that is required to the landowner, that is required until the adequate cleanup is performed, and then the fines, penalties, the cleanup requirements. So the company has presumptive liability and the cleanup responsibility, so it always falls on the company itself.
also, given this is something that was echoed in a lot of the comments, given the lax oversight that we have witnessed in other industry sectors in North Carolina in the past, the coal ash spill certainly on the Dan River, the subsequent revelations that Diener wasn't doing a very good job of policing the coal ash pits that I think there are 31 of them or 33 of them around the state, and other incidents, should citizens have confidence that the rules that are being written will be enforced in a way that not only protects them, but are also sufficiently punishing so that the energy companies and drilling companies that they hire will find it too onerous to break the rules or take shortcuts? Should we trust the state to police the state?
Well, you know, the old Ronald Reagan quip comes to mind, trust but verify. If you can't trust your state government, then you need to replace the leadership. State government. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Well, I guess the question is, have they done anything to let us know that they can be trusted?
Well, you know, if they haven't, then you need to replace the leadership. That's my argument. I'm not going to pass judgment on past regimes in the state. I just tell you that obviously there's an administration that you need to hold accountable and responsible for these things.
Cassie, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, we haven't seen a great example of a strong enforcement regime at Diener, looking back at the coal ash spill. And given the amount of funding that's being directed towards enforcement for fracking, that's going to be based on the income from the taxes and the impact fees and et cetera. The funding may be coming after fracking happens, and what we want to see is strong enforcement set up beforehand.
Okay, when do you think fracking is likely to begin? When, Mr. Womack, in 10 seconds or less, do you think it will actually start?
Well, the rules should be passed in the spring, late or early summer, and I do believe that with a willing industry partner, we'll probably see it late the midsummer, early fall.
James Womack, the former chair of the Mining and Energy Commission, Cassie Gavin with the Sierra Club, and Dr. Andy Bubiarchuk, a geographer and geologist with UNC Charlotte. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of